This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
During the past decade, developing drugs for rare diseases has led to the emergence of a powerful new tool that is impacting drug development for widespread diseases as well: the voice of patients affected by the disease. Patient engagement in the design and conduct of clinical trials has now gone well beyond their mere participation as subjects in those trials. The patient voice, which before recent times was generally ignored or not even included, has become a driver, an influencer, even a success factor in drug development. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of the DIA Global Forum. Today, my guests are two experts who will lead discussions on patient engagement at DIA Europe 2018 in Basel in April. Dr. Christopher McCabe, Executive Director and CEO, Institute of Health Economics Canada. Welcome, Dr. McCabe.
Thank you for having me.
And Dimitrios Athanasiou, a member of the board for United Parent Projects Muscular Dystrophy, the worldwide group of Duchenne patient and patient organizations, and a patient representative to EURORDIS, the voice for rare disease patients in Europe. Welcome, Mr. Athanasiou.
Thank you for having me.
While the value of the patient perspective in clinical research and drug development now seems evident, it hasn't always been this way, has it? So the question is, what has driven the emergence of this perspective in drug research and development?
I think there's two main factors that have driven the recognition of the importance of the patient perspective over the last decade or so. I think the first is, as we have moved into rare diseases being an increasingly important component of the pharmaceutical and biotechnology research and development processes, it's become increasingly essential to have the patient communities on board. The people with these diseases, often their children, so the families of the people affected by these conditions, need to be on board in order for trials to be successful in recruiting. And as the possibility of treatments have become known, the patient communities have organized themselves to be a voice and to demand, quite rightly in my opinion, the development of technologies are addressing the needs of the patients and their families themselves. So it's often no longer sufficient to show that you've got some biological activity and to convince the clinical community to recruit. Actually, the patients in this area are quite rightly saying, yeah, but how's that going to improve my experience of my life with this disease? And so they are engaging early. And in response, I think industry has quite appropriately and understandably returned that engagement and realized that they can have much more effective and efficient recruitment to trials, which is essential to move the knowledge from the lab, from the bench, to the bedside. And so been that as one of the major driving forces, of, as I see it. And I think that's an excellent progress. And I think it's great that that way of working with patient groups and patient communities has translated into more prevalent diseases. And the second factor is from the other end of the R&D process. As we've seen the increasing use of health technology assessment, formal reimbursement decision-making processes in many countries to decide whether a drug gets reimbursed in a health system and thus is available to patients, the patient voice on how valuable a drug is has become very important. It's no longer enough for a technology, a drug, to get licensed. The budget holders in the health system have to make a conscious decision whether they will or will not pay for it. And again, most appropriately, the decision makers listen. Yes, obviously they listen to the clinicians, and yes, obviously they listen to the manufacturers, the developers, but they turn to the patient communities and they say, this drug, what will it do to your experience of your disease? Tell us the value of this drug for you, so that we can then understand and make a more informed decision about whether this technology should be funded, should be made available to you. So from both ends of the R&D process for new technologies, we've seen these two factors, complementary factors, that have reinforced the importance of listening early to the patient communities and taking on board their views about what's really important to improve their health, their quality of life through treating their disease.
Chris, you mentioned a number of stakeholders that you listened to, and interestingly, you didn't mention regulators. So my question would be, if all the stakeholders are in agreement on a new medicine and the patients really want it, but the regulators aren't convinced by the available evidence, do the HTAs listen in any case to the patient voice and perhaps give it a greater weight potentially?
Most HTA agencies will not move forward with reviewing a technology unless it's received regulatory approval. It's important, and you're right, I should have mentioned the regulators. And the regulators are, in Europe and the US and here in Canada as well, increasingly finding a formal place for the patient voice in their decision-making processes. And I think it's completely analogous to the way the regulator, to the reimbursement authorities are, the HTA agencies, are listening to the patient voice. And it comes out of whereas the payers are asking, is this worth it in terms of what do you get in return for what we would have to pay? The regulators are quite appropriately saying, well, every technology, every drug has a balance of expected benefits and risks associated with it. And it's the patients that bear those risks. And so most appropriately, they're saying to the patient communities, tell us what you think about the balance of the risks and the benefits of this technology as we consider whether to give it regulatory approval.
Let's bring the patient voice into the conversation. Dimitrios Athanasiou, as a patient advocate, what is your perspective on the drivers that have brought us to today?
Being in a part of the PDCO, the Pediatric Committee of EMA, so a part of the regulatory, let's say, process, I can confirm that the regulators in both sides of the ocean are moving ahead with the patient voice. I have to say that I'm not very worried about, let's say, how the regulators are involved with the patients. We have seen it working for many years and it's working in a good way. I believe, though, that like many times in the past, the need created the opportunity. So at some moment, all stakeholders realized that we had to deal with the increasing challenges that the drug development is facing. And obviously, we cannot do this alone. None of the stakeholders can face it alone. So we realized, I assume, that we needed to improve the process of the drug development. We definitely need to produce better drugs. We definitely need to produce them more efficiently and design meaningful trials, which is not possible without the input of the patients involved, to minimize the failures that we have. And definitely, we have to increase the patient compliance. Otherwise, we will not have efficient drug in the market in time, especially for rare diseases that we have about 7,000 rough estimations that we're going to need 200 years to have a drug for all of them. So that's the one part, the need. And the second part, I think, is also the patient side that involved enough to deal with the needs that we had to face. The patient movement, I think it became more professional, more mature, and definitely more active. We have access to knowledge that we never had in the past. So that increased the patient involvement and definitely the empowerment. And I think by gaining the knowledge, it allows us to meaningfully contribute as an equal partner in this process.
Let me ask you further, Dimitrios, what have been the obstacles along the way? We might agree that it's taken a long time. Some people would say too long a time for the patient voice to be solicited and listened to. And we are now today in a very favorable stage in this regard. What have been the obstacles along the way for decades? Why wasn't the patient accessed sooner and their opinion solicited sooner, decades ago? Why only now?
On the first glance, we think that at least I thought that the main barrier was knowledge. But if you look in more detail, I think that the true barrier was the mental barriers we all face, thinking that each one of us, as I said, can solve the challenges alone. Also, we had some trust issues that we're working on them. I believe that now we are starting to realize that it's not feasible and sustainable, as Chris said, to develop drugs in the model that we have so far and have at the same time safe, accessible, but also innovative drugs. So I think trust was a key factor in the success of this project.
You mentioned trust. Trust between who and who? Where was the trust not present?
I think the trust between all the stakeholders. You have to build a minimum consensus, and we have to start trust each other. I think that was an issue in the past. We still face it now, but the feeling I have at least is that we start working on that. We're getting.
But specifically, who was not trusting whom? I mean, patients did not trust who?
I believe that patients could not trust anybody, but also the rest of the stakeholders. So I think also the regulators in the past did not trust the contribution of the patients that they can bring into the discussion. Both regulators and patients didn't trust the companies, and the companies also didn't trust to the system and to the patients. So there was a multi-layer breakdown in the trust that we have to build. I don't believe that we cannot point a finger to one, although I come from the patient, let's say, side. If you see it more holistically, I think we realized that everybody has a blame in this blame game, let's say, of lack of trust.
Did the transparency afforded by the internet and the wide availability of information play a key role in helping to build trust in channels of communications among the parties?
I think definitely the access to information helped, but the main factor that helped more, it was the interaction between the regulators and the patients. I think this breaks the first barrier that we feel distant from the decision process and the decision makers. When we realized that they are not all the gatekeepers, but they are partners that we can work with, then it was easier also for us to contribute. But I think also this applies to the other side. Also, I think that the regulators at some moment, they realized that the patient voice can contribute to the discussion much more than the simple risk benefit of the on the decision. It can reach even to the protocol design, to early interactions with the industry. And I think in this process, all three players helped a lot.
Chris, from the perspective of health economics that you represent, what were the obstacles in the old days and how were they overcome in terms of bringing the patient voice into the conversation in drug development and reimbursement?
Andreas has covered a large amount of the information or the issues. I think knowledge was undoubtedly a challenge. Knowledge from both sides. I think the patient's understanding of what is required in both the R&D process and the nature of licensing and reimbursement processes, that knowledge needed to be acquired. Mm-hmm. And the health economists working in this space coming to understand not only what patients' expertise, how it could be brought to bear and could be valuable, but actually the technical, how to do it well, figuring out how to elicit that information in a robust manner and incorporate it in with the other information that is considered in regulatory and reimbursement processes. We work in an environment where, quite rightly, there is substantial external review of what is done. These are very important decisions. They need to be made with good processes. So this idea of procedural justice and accountability for reasonableness, that when bodies make decisions on behalf of society, transparency and consistency and rationality should be demonstrable characteristics. So how to elicit the patient's unique expertise and bring that voice and that expertise into the process in ways that met the requirements for transparency and consistency and rationality. That was a real challenge for us as health economists, and a lot of work has gone into that and continues to go into that. So that sort of technical barrier, a lot of progress has been made, but as I say, there's a lot of work still going on. So I think that was one of the barriers. Trust, definitely, the different organizations and groups, communities needed to spend enough time talking and understanding each other and each other's responsibilities and perspectives to gain trust, undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. And finally, resourcing. Organizing things takes resources. Accumulating knowledge that you don't have takes resources. So it took a while for the budget holders in the regulatory space and in the reimbursement space and within companies to realize that to do this well, they would have to make not massive, but neither negligible amounts of resource available, because the patients, their time is as valuable as any other experts. And so they need to be paid for their contribution in some way. And so I think figuring out how to resource it was also a barrier. But I think we've made a lot of progress on that.
Let's drill down a little more specifically with you both on how patients can contribute to clinical R&D in Europe or globally. What avenues are available for patients to contribute? Dimitrios, let me start with you. From your point of view as a patient advocate, are there avenues, practical avenues for patients to contribute their voice, their perspective, along the lines that Chris was suggesting?
Chris was right. We are in the beginning of the process, and we need to set new goals in order to find, let's say, new vehicles that we can use. Obviously, forums like DAA is one of the important avenues that we can use in order to get involved and be heard and be meaningfully together designed with regulatory partners also in the future. Also, getting organized in patient organizations, in consortia that were working together, working groups, task force. These are essential parts of the equation. We cannot do it by ourselves. And I think the most important vehicles that we can use are the ones that we can build together. I don't think that by ourselves, for example, even a fantastic patient organization can deal with this situation and these challenges alone. We have to work in groups and teams. Working together, I think, is the best way that we can solve it.
If patients are passionate but not technically expert, shall we say, in a particular disease, is that an obstacle? And if it is, do you get around that obstacle by partnering with technical, clinical, medical experts to make the patient voice stronger?
I think in the short run, yes, you can do it. And you need a transfer of expertise in anyway. But in the long run, I don't think it's very productive, to tell you the truth. I believe that patients should train themselves so they can use, for example, like we have in Europe, there's a summer school, can use the European Patient Academy, many programs that the patient organizations have, even programs that the Commission has, European Commission. So yes, we can transfer some knowledge in the beginning, but if we want long-term effects, I think definitely we need the trained patients.
So patients need to educate themselves and train exactly. themselves to be conversant and articulate to be able to advocate effectively?
Exactly. Because although you need the lay patient where everything started, at the end, we need to get more professional. And definitely you need some skills in order to negotiate as an equal partner in a table, either with HTA, either with regulators, either with industry.
Do you find HTAs, regulators, and industry, Dimitrios, to be open to interacting with patients? If a patient reaches out to any of these constituencies, do they find an open door? Do they find a locked door? What do they find?
I think that we moved a lot from the past. So if we look at in the European level, at least, or central level, then it's easier to have access and it's easier to communicate and interact. If you are looking into the local level, because this is a challenge that we're facing many times in Duchenne, then the system is not mature yet. We need some more time for the system to mature. So I think that the national regulators and HTA bodies need a little more time. And in the local level also, we need more work. But starting from the high end, I think that a lot of things have been done and the process is quite successful so far. But of course, there is more to do.
Is the passage of time going to be sufficient or are different strategies necessary, perhaps?
Time is essential, but also different strategies are essential. But the point is who you involve in these strategies and developing together strategies and plans, this makes sense. But you cannot develop a strategy or a plan as a patient organization by yourself when it involves also other stakeholders like regulators or industry.
Chris, your point of view on the avenues that patients can use to reach out, for example, in your space to health economists and HTAs, is this working as well as it should or can it be improved?
Again, Demetrius and I are agreeing with each other possibly more than people expect. I think we're in a time, not the beginning of the beginning, but maybe towards the end of the beginning of a process of culture change where we're moving towards everyone expecting that there needs to be a place for the patient voice in the R&D processes, in the regulatory process, in the reimbursement process. There's a lot of variability in the stage of transition between different organizations and between different countries and health systems. And that just the way things are, you know, it's like the diffusion of a technology. You know, we have our early adopters and then after a while it ramps up and rapidly diffuses. And I sense, I may be an optimist here, that we're moving towards a tipping point where we'll be moving beyond the early adopters and actually it will be much more routine, even relatively local level. So here in Canada, obviously we have our central HTA agency and our regulator, and they're really strongly committed to the patient voice. We're now seeing the uptake of formal mechanisms for incorporating patients in provincial level decision making. I see that in my own province here in Alberta. And so it's a dissemination of this new culture. And I think there is a responsibility for those of us with expertise to reach out and partner with the patients. And initially, the partnering will be to share our expertise with them to help them engage with the current issues. But I think Demetrius is completely correct. Over time, we, as experts, need to share our expertise in the form of training to skill up and help the patient community skill themselves up so that they are equipped to be equal partners on a knowledge base for the discussions that they have with the manufacturers, the regulators, and the reimbursement authorities. It will take time and it will take that different culture that I really think is dispersing through the systems globally. And it will take a willingness of the experts to share and for the patients to accept that they have things to learn and to put in the time and the effort to learn that. But I think all of those things are kind of in play now. So I'm very optimistic that we'll see an acceleration over the next 2 or 3 years of the engagement and the level of engagement and the acceptance of that engagement of the patient communities in these processes.
Chris, can you think of examples where listening to the patient voice has caused you to change your mind on a new medicine, for example, as opposed to informing your decision? Has listening to a patient actually led to a change of opinion on your side or that of your institution?
I don't make decisions. I provide evidence and analysis, and I think it's a very important principle that those of us who are in this role of synthesizing evidence to provide it to decision makers respect that line between the evidence and the decision and are as explicit as possible to the decision maker about where the evidence stops and where their decision making and their interpretation of the evidence and their judgment when there isn't quantitative evidence or even narrative evidence available, where they have to deploy their judgment. That's just kind of a matter of principle to me.
But you do make a recommendation, presumably.
Well, I make summaries of what the evidence indicates, and I say things along the lines of, if you use standard decision rules, the evidence will indicate that this would be good value or this may be poor value for money, those sorts of mm-hmm. things. But I won't go any further than that because I don't have any social legitimacy to do that. Nobody voted me into office to make these decisions. I think it's really important I recognize that. Have there been occasions when hearing the patient's voice has influenced my own views of the evidence and how we should treat the uncertainty? So often, I think, especially with rare diseases, inevitably, we've got highly uncertain evidence base because there's just not enough people to generate large trials with highly certain results. And I think when you hear, for example, the accounts of a parent of a young girl with Gaucher's disease about what that disease before it was treated did to her social life and her self-confidence and her ability to engage in society and therefore her likely trajectory through life, it becomes so much more real. And you can see what quality of life means. And it's much broader than just this sort of simple description of ability to fulfill usual social roles. It really is to understand that quality of life in those early stages of adolescence could determine trajectory. And so that obviously and appropriately influences how you think about the evidence and how certain you need to be before saying, yes, it's a gamble, we are uncertain, but the value of the payoff, if it works, is so much bigger than if you just looked at the health benefit. And I remember similarly in rheumatoid arthritis when the biologics arrived, all the evidence was about this change on this semi-clinical score called the HAQ. But when the patient with rheumatoid arthritis explained what the changes as measured on the HAQ meant for that individual's everyday life, completely changed the sense of the value of successful treatment.
Maybe more real for you, more real?
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes it more real and fills it out. It's not that the evidence that the clinical trial produces isn't real, but it's incomplete. And so the patient voice fills out that evidence and gives you a more comprehensive understanding of the impact of an effective therapy.
Dimitrios, listening to Chris, do you feel that the examples he brings forward reflect the aspirations of your organization and the patient advocacy movement as a whole, that this is what should happen, that in fact the patient voice should have this kind of impact?
I think that this is a fantastic example, and I would like a lot for all our, let's say, partners in the discussions table to be open-minded like Chris. But this is not only always the case. And yes, it will be fantastic, but to tell you the truth, sometimes we are concerned that we're going to become, a fad or a tick on the box process. So is the person involved? Yeah, okay, let's check it. And not really participate in the process. I think that we are also in the young phase as the patient engagement and patient advocacy. I think we should expect more and we should work more on that pathway. Definitely, we need to start earlier than where we are involved now. I believe that Chris placed it very correctly when he said that the standard operation procedure does not apply in rare diseases most of the time. And so we have sometimes old tools to evaluate and deal with a new situation. But we're working towards that. I think there is a lot of work done. Also, we have to have a perspective of the economic environment that we live in. And this is something that we should consider also as patients, but also the rest of the stakeholders. I think that we should start by setting research goals and priorities directly from the very early, and to influence also access and monitoring of the reimbursement and societal priorities. So there is a very big range where the patient advocacy should work on. Unfortunately, in rare diseases, as you mentioned, we don't have enough advocates because it's a rare disease. And knowing the statistics, 50% it comes in childhood, 35% of our children die before 5. So it is a very, very weird situation, and a lot of energy is consumed by the disease. But I believe that with the advocates, the good advocates that we have, we are building there, and we're building also traction in our communities. And I think more people will come forward and will help in this direction. And we definitely have a lot of supporters from the other stakeholders, which I have to mention that they backed up, especially in the initial steps, the patient movement. And I think we should be grateful also for that. But definitely, we're going to challenge them a lot in the future.
The number being circulated these days is 7,000 rare diseases exist in the world. Are there 7,000 patient organizations, one for each of those diseases? Or if not, can an organization like EURORDIS subsume a number of rare diseases that are really too small to have their own advocacy group?
This is the major role of EURORDIS, because if you are looking to rare diseases and if you are looking to the ultra-rare, you can see that we might have 5 patients in the world in a very deliberating disease. You don't expect that these 5 parents can manage to create a world organization. But having said that, there is a lot of energy and a lot of commitment inside the rare disease advocacy. And I think that this separates from the general conditions.
In the minute remaining, let me ask you, at this DIA conference in Basel in April, what will be the hottest patient engagement topics? You've covered several, but is there any hot topic that we've not covered in this conversation, Chris?
Patient engagement in the reimbursement space. The challenge is, in reimbursement, you're talking about allocating money to treatments for an identifiable group of patients who have voice, who we should listen to. But we're often doing that by taking money away from other patients, other healthcare activities, and we often don't know who they are. And I think the biggest challenge for getting patient engagement right and equitable and defensible is to figure out a way to get the voice of those people whose healthcare may be displaced when we fund an expensive but valuable new technology in a health system that has a relatively limited or fixed budget. And I think that's, from the reimbursement world, that's our big challenge. And it's going to take a lot of hard work and a long time to solve, but I think it's essential.
Hot topics, we're going to have a lot. Actually, I'm looking forward for this conference. I think that data ownership, governance, and data sharing is going to be discussed a lot, I hope. Definitely the access is always an issue. And especially if you combine it with the healthcare funding, which I agree with Chris, it's limited and fixed, but I don't agree on the fixed. Definitely on evidence generation and pay per evidence, which is something that will help also the patient, but also the healthcare system. And as a last comment on this, I would like to say that our attendees, definitely we're going to take a lot of a glimpse of the future, but we need also their knowledge, ideas, and commitment in order to design this future together. Because at the end, we're all patients, or if we are not, we will be. So.
Well, thank you both. We've come to the end of our time together. Chris McCabe, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dimitrios Athanasiou, thank you very much for joining. I know you have the plane to catch. Won't hold you any further. And we'll see you both in Basel.
Thank you all.
For the DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.